Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Paris Schatz.
And I'm Amanda Vinicky. Brandis Friedman has the evening off on the show tonight.
No person is above the law in this country.
Legal troubles are mounting for former President Trump as the FBI raids his Florida home. We have the latest.
China has always been threatening Taiwan for years.
Taiwan's top diplomat in Chicago joins us to talk about the escalating crisis as China performs military drills around the island.
We're out here fighting for our passengers right now.
What's driving the wave of recent airline delays and cancellations?
There was never, ever any talk about a TIF to fund this particular project.
The first steps toward creating the Red Line Extension Tax Increment Financing District are taken, but not everyone's on board.
You've probably heard of food deserts, but what impact are pharmacy deserts having on the health of Chicagoans on the south and west sides?
Artists from Chicago and Ukraine join forces in a cry of protest against the ongoing hostilities in that country.
The thing about Grace and Frankie that has been so much fun is it's so challenging.
And we check back in with the Evanston artist behind Netflix's longest-running original series, Grace and Frankie. Great show. But first, some of today's top stories. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox says her office no longer stands behind 8 murder convictions tied to a disgraced former Chicago police detective. That former detective, Ronaldo Guevara, for years allegedly engaged in a, quote, pattern and practice of framing suspects and manipulating evidence.
Rebuilding the community trust in our justice system requires that when we find an injustice, we work diligently to correct it. Today marks another step in that process at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office.
Those charges now dropped. Fox says if any of the exonerated defendants pursue lawsuits, her office will not oppose them. More on this story on our website. A grand jury in Mississippi declines to indict the white woman whose accusation led to the lynching of black teenager Emmett Till. This despite the recent discovery of an unserved arrest warrant filed 70 years ago for the woman, Carolyn Bryant Dunham. The grand jury heard more than 7 hours of testimony from investigators and witnesses, but determined there was insufficient evidence to indict Dunham on charges of kidnapping and manslaughter. The AP reports that the Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., Emmett Till's cousin, and the last living witness to Till's 1955 abduction, is calling the announcement unfortunate but predictable. Up next, a look at what legal troubles former President Trump might face after the FBI raids his home. Stay with us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Former President Donald Trump's legal problems are mounting, the latest of which being the FBI executing a search warrant at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida last night. CNN is reporting the raid is part of an investigation into the handling of presidential documents, including classified material. The former president called the search a, quote, assault, and his supporters and media allies have spun it as a political persecution. And here to talk about the unprecedented search are Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman from Illinois and host of the podcast White Flag with Joe Walsh. Zach Farden, who was U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois from 2013 to 2017, now a partner at King & Spalding. And Renato Mariotti, a legal analyst, also a former federal prosecutor. Welcome all of you back to Chicago Tonight. Zach Farden, remind our viewers what goes into approving a search warrant like this.
Good evening, Paris. So it's a pretty involved process. Two of the three branches of federal government, in fact, have to sign off for this kind of search warrant to occur. The executive branch, which is the Department of Justice, the FBI, the federal prosecutors, and then the judiciary, a federal judge, what the Supreme Court calls a neutral and detached magistrate, whose job it is to look at the search warrant and affidavit and decide if there's probable cause to support the search. And then that judge has to analyze the affidavit and search warrant to determine probable cause, not for one, but for two things. First, that a crime has been committed. And second, that there will be evidence related to that crime in the place to be searched. So it is a very arduous process.
A high standard that has to be met here. Renato Mariotti, why, and it can't be lost on prosecutors here, the optics of something like this. So why do you believe they acted with such urgency in this investigation that's gone on for months that we know of into these classified documents?
Well, you know, as Zach just suggested, they had to have evidence that the evidence that they were looking for in this case actually was in that house. So I suspect that they had fresh evidence or information indicating that this evidence was in the former president's home. And I think one obvious implication here is they thought that they would not obtain that evidence if they just served a subpoena or requested it. That they felt that there was some urgency that they would not actually get the information unless they actually went and seized it.
And that's anyone's speculation right now. Joe Walsh, right away, the president condemns this and then starts sending out a fundraising letter. You've got his allies in the media using similar messaging that it's the deep state, it's a banana republic. How deep is the anger and confusion now among his base?
Good to be with you, Paris. Look, I've never seen the Republican Party base this animated, this angry. Paris, it's even beyond the base. I've heard from so many Republicans in the last 24 hours that you wouldn't consider hardcore Trump supporters who are really bothered by what happened. This is scary because, right, no man's above the law. The Justice Department, the FBI, just doing their job. Trump's a criminal. He's been a criminal his whole life. But politically, Paris, this is going to strengthen Trump within the Republican Party. Of that, I have no doubt.
And it seems like he's kind of taking that approach as well. Zach Fardin, I think back to some of the high-profile raids here in recent years, Ed Burke, Mike Madigan, Kerry Austin. Do prosecutors and investigators and agents think about the optics of high-profile cases like this and how this might be perceived in the media once they do it?
100%, yes. And in a situation like this, you know, yes, no one is above the law. In the next breath, I'll say that this search warrant in this process received much more scrutiny from many more eyes at high-level, experienced prosecutive levels up to the AG than a search of my home or your home, Paris, would ever involve. So, yeah, this is going to be probable cause plus. They're going to be very mindful of the attention that this would collect. I don't think any of the fallout that is being realized right now would not have been contemplated through that process, which to me means that they're going to be very buttoned down and very careful about making sure that not only they have the evidence to support that search warrant affidavit, but also that it is sufficiently prudent and necessary, to Renato's point, necessary to collect evidence and information related to criminal conduct, that it warrants that kind of fallout.
Renato, this case of the president allegedly taking materials that belong in the National Archives, not giving them back, some of them possibly sensitive, some of them possibly classified, how serious a potential crime is it, and what kind of potential punishment does it carry?
Well, it is a felony. It would carry a prison sentence, up to years in prison. I will say that typically the Justice Department doesn't prosecute cases involving mishandling of classified information unless there's a willful transfer to a third person. I really suspect that there's more to the story that we don't know. Obviously, we don't know, but it's very unlikely in my view that this was just purely that there was some classified information and this is how the Justice Department sought to obtain it. We'll learn more about that, but perhaps they were misled by Trump's attorneys regarding it, or there was some other reason, whether it's the destruction of evidence or something else, sharing of evidence to third parties that they felt they needed to go in.
Joe Walsh, you mentioned this is strengthening Trump in the Republican Party. This seems to be a dynamic we've seen play out over the last 5-6 years. When he seems to be in legal trouble, he spins it around and plays the victim, and it works. Explain that dynamic for us.
Yeah, Paris. nothing is better for Trump than when he can say, I'm the victim, the deep state is coming after me, and they're coming after you too. My God, I've heard from hundreds of Republicans today who've told me those very words. So once again, this weird dynamic's going to happen where Trump is going to be stronger in the Republican Party. And I think this will compel him to come out and announce sooner than he would have. But I do believe it's going to make him much weaker in the body politic outside the Republican Party because it puts the spotlight on him. And it reminds every American of what an unfit, corrupt guy he is.
Zach Fartin, to those concerns among Trump supporters, from what you've seen, do you have any reason to believe politics plays any role in this or that that in some way this is a political persecution?
I don't, Paris. I mean, two points. First, to my personal experience, a dozen years with the Justice Department, and especially in situations like these that are going to be highly scrutinized, politics are put aside. These lawyers aren't that stupid. These agents aren't that stupid to let politics be the chin that leads them to a punch from the public on something as important as this. Second point, equally important, Christopher Wray, the FBI director, is a Trump appointee. He is himself a Republican. He is somebody I've known for decades. He is a person of honesty and integrity, and I do not believe he's going to allow politics to have infected his decision-making process. I believe they're going to be very buttoned down from a process perspective, and that facts that come may or may not come out eventually, but that we don't currently know, absolutely warrant and justify the necessity of doing this by search warrant and not some other lawful process.
And Zach, I'll stay with you on this. And again, going back to some of the high-profile raids we've seen here, Burke, Kerry Austin, Mike Madigan, et al., the indictments usually came within a few months after that. When you have a high-profile search warrant like this, does that mean that a case, an investigation, is close to the level where charges might be brought, or not necessarily?
Well, not necessarily is the answer. You're right that typically a search warrant comes toward the end of a process because it's usually a pretty loud event in a law enforcement investigation, and you save that. You do everything covertly before you do anything overtly. This is potentially different, we're speculating, but because of the issue of classified information. It would be a legitimate law enforcement end to itself to recollect classified information that has been misappropriated or is someplace that it should not be held. And so we really don't know, and it would be pure speculation to suggest that charges are coming at all or when those might come, particularly in light of that underlying nature of the potential offense.
Renato Mariotti, there's also plenty of reporting about the DOJ's alleged interest in Trump's actions in and around January 6th. Would you assume that that is a separate investigation that's going on, or could these be tied together somehow?
Given the public reporting by numerous sources that this is related to classified documents, it doesn't seem to be connected to the January 6th investigation. I mean, the recent reports that we've heard regarding that involve, you know, Pence aides, Mark Short and others who had testified regarding this so-called fake elector scheme. I don't think that has any obvious connection to this. So this appears to be unconnected from that January 6th investigation.
And Joe Walsh, we have Republican leader Kevin McCarthy now threatening investigations of the investigators of Attorney General Merrick Garland if the GOP assumes congressional control. Do you anticipate if they do take back the House, there's just going to be investigation hearing after hearing on some of these things?
Hunter Biden, Hunter Biden, Hunter Biden. That's probably all you're going to hear about. Yeah, Paris, the Republicans, all they're going to do is investigate people. What I am more concerned about is this. The language that McCarthy and all of my former colleagues and people on Fox News and right-wing talk radio used last night and today, and even so many Republican elected officials, is so irresponsible and has been so dangerous. I worry about violence. It's like they haven't learned anything from January 6th, these Republicans. They don't care. And I really worry that we're looking at violence.
Yeah, and we should note, we really don't know very much about this other than what's been out there and what's been reported, and there really aren't that many conclusions we can jump to. But all three of you have been very responsible with your analysis, and we appreciate it. Our thanks to Joe Walsh, Zach Farden, and Renato Mariotti.
Thanks, Paris.
And now to Amanda and the unending airport delays. Amanda.
Paris, a wave of airline delays and cancellations is affecting much of the country. Just yesterday, 45% of flights out of O'Hare were delayed. That's according to flight tracker FlightAware. On top of that, pilots are raising alarms around issues like fatigue. Joining us to talk about it are Dennis Tejer, an American Airlines pilot and spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association, a union representing American Airlines pilots, and Joseph Schwederman, professor in the School for Public Service at DePaul University. Thanks to each of you. We did also, by the way, reach out to American Airlines for their perspective. The company did not respond to our request. So, Joe, to you, what on earth and in the skies is causing these recent cancellations and delays?
Yeah, what a summer it's been. We just had in June tremendous cancellations, and it was something we hadn't seen in aviation for quite some time during a peak season like that. The airlines tried to respond, cut flights, they made some adjustments, but boy, now we have late flights that are just chronic, and O'Hare was center stage for that. It seems like every airline picks the day it wants to have a bad day, and this week was really tough for American and United.
And so to you, Dennis, recently you did have American Airlines pilots picketing downtown. Now, this was not a strike. It was informational. What do pilots want their company, as well as the public, to be aware of?
We've got to fix this. It's at management's feet. It's their hands that they weren't prepared for the recovery. They didn't have pilots trained like they were supposed to with the $54 billion investment. Sure, it kept the airlines from collapsing. But American did not keep pilots current and trained. They're still suffering from that. And they sold tickets, as Secretary Buttigieg has said, they sold tickets that they can't service. And as Joe mentioned, in June, 800,000 passengers impacted by cancellations at American. In July, 500,000. Now in August, month to date, 200,000. That puts them on track to match that worst month of June. And in Chicago, the weekend you're talking about, took a look at that. 144 flights in American, 22,000 passengers, and 42% of those flights, some of it was weather, but the recovery, 42% of those flights canceled after that were due to inability to connect a pilot to the airplane. It's the fundamentals of airline business, and they have failed to do that going into the second summer. And there's a fix.
And so, Dennis, that's leaving pilots who are able to fly planes, such as yourself, responsible for taking up more jobs. That's leaving you tired? That's scary. Nobody wants a sleepy pilot.
Well, you're not going to get one. That's the good news. The FAA mandates that we don't fly when we're fatigued. Before every flight, I have to check a box that says fit for duty. Duty. My duty is to protect our passengers. So even if I'm legal, I am not permitted to fly the airplane if I'm fatigued. But here's the catch. When you're fatigued, the first thing that goes is your judgment. So we're trained professionals and we manage that, but they are recklessly utilizing us to try and pack more into the schedule. And we have a saying on the flight deck, just because it's legal does not mean it's safe or smart. Now we're gonna hold up that margin of safety against that pressure, but we're human. You've got to stop pushing this.
So, Joe Schwederman, is this more a worker shortage or a worker conditions issue? Certainly it's a traveler's one, but on the other end.
Yeah, it's really a gradual process. You know, many years ago when I worked in the airline industry, it was a job of choice that people wanted to stay for life, and it was a family and so forth. And boy, the pandemic has just sort of ripped away at that airline culture. I mean, of course, passengers got unruly with the mask mandate. As Dennis saying, the recovery has been packed in full flights. And it's just led to a much more stressful environment. So when you throw these cancellations and delays on there, you know, the nerves get frayed. And of course, for pilots, it really affects the quality of their job. So we're seeing attrition for pilots, a lot of hours needed to hire new pilots. So I think the airlines won't maybe admit it, but they let too many pilots incentivize pilots to retire. And now that recovery has been so rocky, is going to take quite a few months to work its way out. But they did take preemptive actions and cancel quite a few flights for August and beyond. But that hasn't proven to have been enough. And
so could they bring any of those retired pilots back? That's something that during the pandemic, governments enticed retired doctors, for example, to help with healthcare worker shortages.
Well, great question. It's surprising, I think, how many pilots, once they leave, say, you know, maybe going back isn't my first choice. They landed another carrier, perhaps. There's a lot of jobs in air cargo that are less stressful. And Dennis could certainly take a whack at that question, because it just takes many, many months to ramp up. And Americans are ready to go. I mean, this pent-up demand is really exciting. Despite high fuel prices, those airplanes are packed. And it's just the formula is not working right now.
Well, and Dennis, actually, the Department of Transportation has stepped in federally. Refresh us. What's DOT trying to do to get airlines in line?
Well, Secretary Buttigieg has said you need to stress test your operation, not just for clear sunny days. And they haven't. He said you also need to not sell tickets that you can't service. Hear, hear. All sounds like logic. But to that point of pilots coming back from retirement, Joe hit it right on the head. A lot of training is required. This is where the epic failure, particularly at American, is at, is in the training of the pilots, because they didn't do their homework. They weren't prepared for school day, which is the recovery. And here we sit. And so now the investment, the $54 billion taxpayers put in to ensure that we're ready for the recovery, we're sitting here. I flew empty airplanes out of Chicago with doctors on board, empty airports. It's hard for me to process that what all these people want to fly, our management team was not ready to get it done. And
well,
we're
just
flying
briefly, Dennis, because, of course, it does take, as you noted, what, at least 1,500 hours or something of flight time. There's a lot that goes into it. When might this get resolved? More pilots?
We'll go with the airline CEOs, from Scott Kirby at United to our CEO. It's going to be a few years. That's how far behind they are. And there are no quick fixes to this. You know, at American, a pilot getting hired today won't touch an airplane with passengers on it until next year. That's how far behind they are, 6 to 7 months in
Yikes.
Getting pilots trained.
Yikes to those who are looking to fly and to jet off somewhere nice. So last to you, Joseph Schwederman, what do travelers need to keep in mind briefly as you're booking a flight or if you're on one of those canceled ones?
You know, we're seeing airlines respond the best they can, in a lot of cases, grounding those smaller airplanes, going to bigger airplanes so they can stretch that labor a little farther. For passengers, though, we're really seeing that interest in nonstop flights, avoiding those connections if you can. And I think coming to the airport with a sort of a plan B in mind. If your flight is late, bring something to read, bring some food, sort of plan mentally how you're going to handle being with thousands of other people who often are stuck. And a lot of people come to the airport, I think, you know, psychologically spent before the trip even starts.
Pack that carry-on instead of checking your luggage, all those sort of things. Bring reading material or your app to watch Chicago Tonight for apps or a podcast. Thanks so much to Dennis Tejer and to Joseph Schwederman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now up next, artists unite in a creative protest against the ongoing war in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Much of the story of Latinos in America is that of entrepreneurship. About 5 million Latino-owned businesses currently exist in the U.S.
Predominantly Latino communities often bear the environmental burden of heavy industry. Residents of those communities say they have a hard time making their concerns heard.
A Chicago-based photographer has a personal understanding of immigration, and he has spent years documenting small businesses.
The forces of gentrification can make people being priced out of their neighborhoods feel powerless. But the founders of Lolita's Bodega say residents have more power than they think.
There's much more ahead on the program, including Taiwan's top diplomat in Chicago and escalating tensions with China. But first, an art show near a Ukrainian village is a cry of protest against the ongoing war in Ukraine. Artists from Chicago and Ukraine are raising their voices in opposition to the Russian invasion. Producer Mark Vitale visited the ARC Gallery for a look at life and art during wartime.
There's a sense of urgency in the new artwork and allusions to the past. One painting uses a World War II uniform as a canvas. Beyond the art in the physical gallery, there are virtual views of artwork from around the world made specifically for the show. The call for entries brought a big response.
I looked at all of the 325 images that were submitted, by 89 artists, and I didn't make any kind of selection at first. I wanted to see what the tone was of all the work. And I recognized that each artist would have a highly personalized response to the call, which was to respond to the impact of war. We needed the voices of artists who were there, or who had experienced this trauma, or who were keeping diaries of events. The bombing of Mariupol had, we saw a number of kind of bombed out apartment buildings, and also in Kyiv and Kharkiv and just all over. And there's this sense of kind of fate and randomness that occurs with war. I think whether you get hit with the bullet or your apartment's bombed or your neighbor's is random.
The exhibition is at ARC Gallery, founded by women artists in Chicago in 1973. Their latest show was selected by the curator of the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. Her mother was born in Ukraine before World War II.
My mother is from Poltava. She escaped during World War II, was allowed to emigrate, and we eventually ended up in Chicago. I'm first generation American, but I have coworkers whose mothers are in Kyiv, and they're calling every day to make sure that they're okay. So they're constantly getting updates, but we were also just traumatized by the news and glued to the media and trying to figure out kind of what do we do because we're here.
Documentary photos reveal life in an underground bunker. Other images bear witness to what is happening. The show is titled The Invisible Costs of War, and many works display a concern for children caught up in all wars.
The invisible costs of war are the emotional, behavioral, spiritual, psychological effects that sometimes appear a lot later. There's a very conscious awareness and fear of what this is going to do to the children that are living through this. Will they think that this is normal? Protecting children is part of Ukrainian culture, but also probably provoked by this kind of situation. Mothers really watch out for the children while the fathers are out fighting.
For Chicago Tonight, this is Mark Vitale.
And the show is at the ARC Gallery on Chicago Avenue through Saturday, and you can find out more on our website. And still to come on Chicago Tonight, the first steps toward creating a Red Line Extension TIF district are taken, but not everyone's on board. Tensions run high across the Taiwan Strait as China performs live-fire military exercises around the island, and then Taiwan responds with military drills of its own. You probably heard of food deserts, but what impact are pharmacy deserts having on the health of Chicagoans on the south and west sides?
The thing about Grace and Frankie that has been so much fun is it's so challenging.
And we check back in with an Evanston artist behind Netflix's longest-running original series, Grace and Frankie. But first, some more of today's top stories. Sources confirmed to WTTW News the Chicago Police Department's head of constitutional policing and reform has been forced out by Superintendent David Brown. Robert Boyk had been the point person at CPD, ensuring the department complies with the federally mandated consent decree. Boyk previously served as chief of staff to former superintendents Eddie Johnson and Charlie Beck. CPD confirmed that Boyk was no longer with the department but did not give a reason for the termination. Sources tell WTTW News Boyk had asked for additional staffers to help train police officers to comply with that consent decree. Brown refused and instead took away 46 officers. Sources say that move made it harder for CPD to meet many of the consent decree demands. Now, CPD says Tina Scahill, who is a top deputy to Brown, will take over the Office of Constitutional Policing and Reform effective today. Workers at Howard Brown Health, one of the nation's largest LGBTQ organizations, have unionized. 97% of workers voted in favor of creating the union with the Illinois Nurses Association. Workers launched the union campaign earlier this year, alleging low staffing and long hours, among many other issues. It's a little trouble in paradise today. Standout linebacker Roquan Smith has officially requested a trade from the team. This as negotiations for a new contract stall. Smith put out a statement saying that it was, quote, a dream come true to put the Bears helmet on. However, he says he believes, quote, the new front office doesn't value him. He left open the possibility of the McCaskey family, which owns the Bears, to step in, but as of now, he says he does not see a path forward. And now, Amanda, we toss it back to you.
Thanks, Paris. The proposal to use property tax money to fund the multi-billion dollar extension of the CTA's Red Line faces a murky future. Members of a city-backed commission voted to get started on the Lightfoot-backed proposal. It would create a new tax increment financing district, or TIF, along the southern branch of the CTA Red Line to generate hundreds of millions for the project by funneling a portion of the increase in property tax revenues from the 42nd, 3rd, 4th, 11th, and 25th wards. But some members of City Council say it would harm their residents. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now with more. Thanks so much, Heather. Now, what makes this proposal to finally get the Red Line extension off the ground so unusual?
Well, this five-mile extension of the Red Line, which I should say has been under consideration since the 1950s, would be funded with property taxes from residents and businesses of downtown and areas south of the Loop, which are really booming. But of course, those neighborhoods are miles away from where these new train tracks will be led. And there's some question about whether they would benefit from this train line extension.
And so perhaps they're older people frustrated that their residents would be paying for an extension that those voters wouldn't be directly benefiting from, right?
Exactly.
So in a rare appearance to publicly oppose a proposal backed by the mayor, Alderman Pat Dowell had this to say about it.
I'm also concerned with the potential precedent being set that will allow geographically unconnected projects to be funded just by simply rating well-capitalized TIFs. The more I analyzed the proposal, studied its impact on my community, and talked with my city council colleagues about their experience with the transit TIF, the more I realized that this was a bad deal for my residents.
So why does Alderwoman Dowell think this transit TIF is a bad deal for residents of her ward, which does include Bronzeville?
So tax increment financing districts are a very complicated way that the city uses growth in property tax revenues to fight blight. And if money that is generated in Bronzeville essentially heads south to this new train extension, there will be less money available for improvements in Bronzeville, which might be booming now, but has faced decades of disinvestment. And that's not something Alderman Dowell said she's prepared to support, because finances, you know this, Amanda, it's a zero-sum game.
Yep, never enough money. That is another thing we know. Now, we also have Alderman Beal, whose ward would benefit from this, opposing the proposal. How come?
Well, he has been working for this for decades, literally, but he says this isn't the right way to do it, mostly because he says this should be the responsibility of the federal government. They should pick up the whole multi-billion dollar price tag through the federal infrastructure project and basically carry the entire burden. I don't know if that's possible, but he is going to push for it. He said the city should send delegations to D.C. and Springfield. And I should say that Alderman Beal is a frequent critic of Lori Lightfoot, so it is not perhaps surprising that he's on the opposite side of this issue.
Right. Typically, the federal government requires matching dollars from local governments to fund projects such as these. So, Heather, what is next?
Well, as you said today, the Community Development Commission started the process to create this brand new transit TIF district, but there is a long way to go, and it must be signed off on by the Chicago City Council, which seems perhaps in doubt after today's public appearances. I reached out to the mayor's office for a response to Alderman Dowell's comments. They did not get back to me, so we'll have to keep a close eye on this one.
We certainly will. Thanks so much, Heather.
Thanks, Amanda.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website, WTTW.com/news. And now to Paris and Taiwan's top diplomat in Chicago, Paris.
Amanda, now we turn to the local view of the conflict between Taiwan and China. China's People's Liberation Army is performing live fire military exercises in the waters around Taiwan for the sixth straight day. The exercises are a very visible illustration of China's apparent fury over last week's visit to the island by a congressional delegation led by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But earlier today, Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu said China's anger over Pelosi's visit was simply a pretext for China to launch military drills to help prepare for a future invasion. Speaking to CNN, Wu admitted that he was worried.
I worry that China may really launch a war against Taiwan. But what it is doing right now is trying to scare us. And the best way to deal with it, to show to China that we are not scared.
And joining us now with more is Johnson Jiang, Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Chicago, Taiwan's de facto consulate here in the city of Chicago. Director General Jiang, thank you so much for joining us. Are you worried, like the foreign minister there, that these exercises could lead to some kind of conflict in the near future?
Well, I think as the minister said, we are extremely concerned about provocative escalation by Beijing to use Speaker Pelosi's visit as a pretext to conduct military drills against Taiwan and also destabilizing regional security, including in the waters of Japan. So we are concerned, extremely concerned about that. However, on the other hand, we also call for dialogues for differences. And in the meantime, Taiwan will be continued to be self-restrained.
And why do you think China has chosen to make such a big deal of Pelosi's visit? You mentioned you believe this is just pretext. Do you think that China was going to do this regardless?
I think to some degree China answered that question. You know, somebody said that 25 years ago, Speaker Gingrich went to Taiwan in 1997, and Beijing didn't fire a bullet. And nowadays, they conduct huge military exercises around the waters of Taiwan and in Japan's EEZ, exclusive economic zone. So I think Beijing answered that. They seems like nowadays they are bigger, they're stronger, so the approach is either my way or highway.
And what's the impact?
It is unacceptable.
And what's the impact been on Taiwan, but also on global trade, considering how much passes through the Taiwan Strait there?
About 50% of global cargo ships go through Taiwan or Taiwan Strait, and Taiwan plays a critical role in global high-tech supply chain, especially semiconductors. Taiwan produced about 90% of global advanced computer chips, semiconductor chips. So as we face the challenges from this pandemic, it is important that we have a stable environment for people to do business. So we think that the military drills against Taiwan is overreacting, unnecessary, provocative. Of course, it presents challenges for businesses. In this regard, we hope China to stop and also back to the dialogue channel to resolve differences.
Give us a sense of how the people of Taiwan feel. Are they open to some kind of peaceful reunification in some point with China, or would they prefer the world to recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation?
I think Taiwan is democracy. And in our view, we think we should let people in Taiwan, Taiwanese people, decide their own future. And from our perspective, Taiwan has been an independent, Republic of China and Taiwan has been independent from the PRC. And we don't belong to a jurisdiction of a PRC. And that's the fact nowadays on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. So the problem is, how do we resolve differences on both sides of the Taiwan Strait? From our view, we think we should let people have a say. about their thinking, about their life, about the way they should be governed. Obviously, we have different views about how people's lives should be governed. That's a fundamental question we face. We think democracy is better for our people, and across the Taiwan Strait, they don't think so. And they think dictatorship works better for them.
And are you satisfied with the U.S. and most of the world kind of sticking with the one China policy, but having diplomatic relations with Taiwan, or do you want the U.S. to do more?
I think that the U.S. one China policy is a different from PRC's one China principle. There are several elements in U.S. one China policy, been there for a long time, over four decades. I mean, in addition to three communiques between the U.S. and China, there are Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, and also six assurances in 1982. And all those elements being reiterated by consecutive administrations across party lines for decades. So the policy has been there, and I don't think the U.S. has changed their policy since. In this regard, I think this is important data, under the Taiwan Relations Act, Taiwan can have a strong deterrence. We wanted to avoid war. The purpose of deterrence is to avoid war. If Taiwan's weak some way, maybe it's more risky to have military conflict between both sides of Taiwan Strait. On the other hand, it's also very important that we have diplomacy. We have diplomacy to bring people to talk. I think that's also important. So that's why from Taipei's perspective, we urge for dialogues without a precondition. And nowadays, China continues to refuse, rejecting our idea to have a dialogue, sit down and talk.
And so China's position is they want preconditions for the two of you to sit down and talk. Very briefly, we mentioned this is the de facto consulate for Taiwan in Chicago. What is Taiwan's relationship with Chicago in the Midwest?
We have very long-standing cooperation with the Midwest, especially in academic cooperation with the universities here. And I think right here in the Midwest, we have top-rated universities, including the Chicago area, Northwestern, UChicago, UIUC, UIC, U.S. System. And we have a huge talent pool here in the Midwest. I think that provides good opportunities for Taiwan businesses coming here to the Midwest. And actually, this is something our office would like to continue to do. When economic security matters national security, we encourage companies to be more diversified, because over the past few decades, we have a lot of business in China. As you can see from the military accesses nowadays, we think it's much more important for our companies to diversify their supply chains, to have more cooperation with democracies like the U.S. And the Midwest provides good opportunities for our business to come here.
Our office
continues to support.
Business, of course, a good form of diplomacy. Very important issues you're dealing with. Our thanks to Director General Johnson Jiang. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And now to Amanda for a look at the impact of pharmacy deserts across the city. Amanda.
Thanks, Paris. You might have heard about food deserts, areas where access to fresh food might not be easily accessible. But pockets of Chicago, particularly on the south and west sides, also lack convenient access to a local pharmacy. Joining us to talk about it are Cheyenne Daniels, a reporter with The Hill and a contributor with the Chicago Sun-Times. Daniels recently published a report with WBEZ on pharmacy deserts, and the researcher credited with coining the term pharmacy desert, Dima Cato, now director of the University of Southern California School of Pharmacy Program on Medicines and Public Health, previously at the University of Illinois Chicago. Thanks to each of you. And Dima, let's begin with you. You, again, literally coined the term pharmacy desert. We know that, of course, medicines, prescriptions can be life-saving. But outside of the obvious, why are pharmacy deserts so problematic?
Well, pharmacies are vital to communities. They provide access not only to medicines, but a variety of other essential services, including vaccinations. And their kind of critical role in promoting public health in the community became very clear since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Any particular ways that you think this really was amplified during COVID?
In the beginning, pharmacies were key in testing, COVID testing. And later on for COVID vaccinations, more than 75% of people that got their COVID vaccine got it at a retail pharmacy. And it became problematic when communities had a hard time finding pharmacies, let alone pharmacies that offered the vaccine. And in Chicago, those communities were on the South and West sides. And that for me wasn't not really kind of surprising, given that we knew that these communities are pharmacy deserts. And
Cheyenne, you, as well as WBEZ's reporters, did analyze this and really kind of drilled down more into where there are pharmacy deserts within Chicago. Can you summarize those findings?
Yeah, I think that what we saw was, especially based on Professor Cato's research, is that most of these pharmacy deserts are on the South and West sides. When we look at places like where Roseland, for instance, is one of those areas that has seen multiple locally owned pharmacies as well as conglomerates close over the past few years. And especially during the civil unrest of 2020, we saw quite a few of those stores close, in part due to lootings that they experienced. And so it's really in predominantly Black and brown neighborhoods that these pharmacies have closed and taken away these services that these residents need.
Now, you touched on there are these big box kind of brand names, the Walgreens really in Chicago as well as CVS, but also a dwindling number of independent pharmacies. So, Dima, why is that? And what role in particular do both insurance companies and government policies play?
So when we talk about chains, so yes, Walgreens is the predominant chain in the city of Chicago. I think that's long been recognized. But independents play a really important role in communities of color, including in the South and West sides, including in pharmacy deserts. So even though pharmacies are far away, the nearest pharmacy is more likely to be an independent than a chain. And in terms of, you know, government players, particularly in the state of Illinois, Medicaid, you know, they play a huge role, them and, you know, the pharmacy benefit managers that they contract with. And I say that for two reasons. One, pharmacies aren't reimbursed enough, especially pharmacies that we know serve predominantly publicly insured populations and therefore rely on Medicaid and reimbursement rates to stay open. And two, Medicaid is also responsible for determining, you know, where their beneficiaries could go to fill their medications. And oftentimes that's a chain. And for some plans like Aetna Medicaid, that chain is not Walgreens. That was, you know, that was discussed in the WBZ Sometimes story that Cheyenne co-wrote. It's CVS. And we know CVS isn't really conveniently located in these neighborhoods. So what that means is that there are fewer patients entering these independents, these non-preferred pharmacies, and therefore fewer prescriptions filled, less money for the pharmacy, and therefore making it really difficult to stay open.
Hard for them to survive without customers who can shop there for those medicines. Now, at the same time, Cheyenne, while there's certainly, it sounds like, an opportunity for government policy to change to fix this problem, Illinois is also giving pharmacists the opportunity to do more, to give vaccines. And also, a new law will allow pharmacists to prescribe hormonal contraception, birth control, without a doctor's prescription. But they can't do that if there isn't a nearby pharmacy to go to, right?
Exactly. And I think one of the real fallouts of that we see is that it really impacts Black and brown women. And we already know that Black women, especially when it comes to maternal health care, maternal mortality rates, infant mortality rates, they have some of the worst health outcomes, if not the worst health outcomes, than especially their white counterparts. And so having access to things like hormonal contraception can be a life-saving service at their disposal that they can't access without having these pharmacies in their communities.
Dima, how does Chicago stack up to other cities when it comes to pharmacy deserts?
It's the worst in terms of the difference between Black and brown communities and white neighborhoods. So the disparities. Mm-hmm. The disparities is just kind of starking, right? With 1% of white neighborhoods in the city of Chicago, we found were pharmacy deserts compared to 42%, almost a half of black neighborhoods.
And Dima, just
5% of Hispanic neighborhoods.
Dima, briefly, we, of course, some people do get their medicine online. Why is that not an option, or does that change things at all?
So very few people get all their medicines online. We know that. And it's really not the solution, right? Because we're not talking about just prescriptions. So aside from the fact that pharmacies are providing other services, right? So the pharmacy is there not only to give you a medication, but there's other services they provide, including the COVID vaccine, right? Again, that was right. A great natural experiment about the importance of pharmacies. We've been trying to kind of argue it for 10 years, but COVID made it easy for us because it became apparent to the public quite quickly that if you want to partner and deliver essential services to the community, the pharmacy is the place to go.
And Cheyenne, last word goes to you. When you were interviewing people for your article, what were you hearing from folks?
Yeah, there's a lot of despair. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration. But there's also these ideas that, especially from many of the women that I spoke to and even local pharmacy owners that are saying, you know, it's possible to have these pharmacies in our neighborhoods. We just need the investment for it. We need the commitment from conglomerates, especially to say, we do believe that you deserve to have these services in your in your communities, and we're going to bring that by putting our pharmacy in your community.
Thank you so much, Cheyenne Daniels and Dima Cato. Up next, meet the Evanston-based artist behind Netflix's Grace and Frankie series. But first, a look at the weather.
It's been about 3 years since we introduced you to the artist behind the artwork on the hit Netflix series, Grace and Frankie. With the show's final season officially out, arts correspondent Angel Ito figured it was time to take us back to the artist's studio in East Rogers Park for a visit.
For the last 8 years, Nancy Rosen has created the artwork behind Netflix's longest-running original series, Grace and Frankie.
When Grace and Frankie calls, it's always a Hollywood emergency. And, you know, so, you know, I just kind of go, they call, and then my life is like, my husband watches my head and it goes click, click, click. And that's the thing about doing a painting for them. If it's for an episode, that it starts out one thing and it keeps morphing until it's done.
But those chaotic clicks were put on hold when the pandemic forced production to shut down after creating the first four episodes of the final season. Rosen says this pause allowed her to work on personal projects, some she'd never have done if it weren't for the series.
I did a whole series of dogs because I did the poodles for them. And then somebody said to me, would you do a portrait of my dog? And normally I'd be like, No. But painting the dog was so much fun.
But once production resumed, it was full steam ahead.
Season 7, they hadn't called me most of the season. And then all of a sudden, it was like, this painting is as serious as a heart attack. And, you know, and I will miss that because it's like, I clearly... this is it for me. I'm going to do this my whole life, right?
When the show wrapped, Rosen received personal items she'd lent to production to make Frankie's art studio more personable.
So they either rented stuff from me or commissioned, like, you know, like if I did the painting of Jane, that was for an episode. Mm-hmm. So they owned that painting. Mm. So these are paintings that I just loaned them.
Mm-hmm. For background props.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So these all just would, like if you go and you look at Frankie's studio,
wow.
These will just be in the background,
uh-huh.
Kind of.
Yeah.
There's a lot of my stuff that's just, my favorite part is that her studio
is your studio.
Was, yes, yeah, so there's all my little stuff.
I remember you said, yeah. They were like, can you send some paintbrushes?
Yeah, and my little tchotchke things that are, you know, my old paint, you know.
We also looked back at some memorable pieces from past seasons.
Lily loved playing Frida. So she asked me to do a painting of Frankie, as Lily as Frida as Frankie. So after they finished filming, they presented Lily with the painting of Frida and Jane the painting of her as Count Drinkula. That was pretty special.
Rosen says the exposure from working on Grace and Frankie over the last 8 years led her to be commissioned to create more than 800 pieces. And while she doesn't know what's next, she looks forward to continuing the work that led her to this journey.
It's like a welcome wave that came into my life and went like this and this and this and this and this. And then it's gone. And it's just left me with really lovely, wonderful feelings and knowing, you know, like I would love to do more. I like the interruption of, you know, today you're going to draw a toilet or a robot that is a woman that makes donuts, but they're really bagels with sprinkles. And you're like, oh, I've never thought of a robot in my entire life, let alone a woman robot, you know? So I think that's what I will miss the most.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angel Ito.
What a lot of fun pieces of art there. And you can visit our website for more information on Nancy Rosen's original artwork. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Please join us tomorrow night live at 7. Intense rainstorms in downstate Illinois. We take a look at what's driving the extreme weather.
Plus, why the city is blocking Navy Pier's attempt to build a transient marina. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Amanda Vinicky.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a great evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm whose attorneys embrace a culture of philanthropy and service by volunteering their time, expertise, and guidance to help others in the greater Chicago community.